Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has two oral arguments divided into with several cases in them. The first oral argument will be Mid-Century Insurance Company of Texas versus Jack Kidd from El Paso County, which will be consolidated with Nationwide Mutual Insurance Company versus Catherine Gerlich from Bexar County. The second oral argument will be In re Missouri Pacific Railroad Company, doing business as Union Pacific Railroad Company, all of these are original mandamus proceedings, consolidated with In re Missouri Pacific Railroad Company, doing business as Union Pacific Railroad Company, consolidated with In re Southern Pacific Transportation Company and Missouri Pacific Railroad Company, doing business as Union Pacific Railroad Company, and In re Union Pacific Railroad Company. In the first argument, we have allotted 30 minutes for each side to present argument, and in the second argument, 25 minutes for each side. This is a historic for our court. Only the third time in the last 108 years that we've sat outside of Austin, and we're doing so pursuant to a constitutional amendment adopted by the voters at the last general election. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioners in the first causes.
May it please the court. Petitions will be represented by Mr. Kurt Paxson and Mr. Melvin Krennic. Petitions have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Paxson will open with the first 15 minutes.
My name is Kurt Paxson from El Paso, Texas. The issue today is whether an insurance carrier is entitled to offset PIP payments against the UM benefits under your standard Texas personal auto policy. The source of the PIP credit is contract. The Texas Department of Insurance promulgated a standard contract of insurance for use in all 254 counties. The facts of our case are simple. The amount of actual damages was liquidated by jury verdict at $13,000 in the Kidd case. The amount of actual damages was within the UM policy limits. The trial court and the 8th Court of Appeals disallowed an offset for the PIP payments of $10,000. Which meant that the carrier was forced to pay double on the very same element of damage. In other words, $10,000 in medical bills was paid under PIP. Those very same bills from the very same doctors were then introduced and according to the 8th Court of Appeals, would be required to be paid again under the UM portion of the policy.
But this very same party paid double premiums, one for the PIP and one for the UM.
Yes, sir. The way it works is you have to have separate premiums when you go in to buy a policy of insurance. When you buy insurance today,
if you charge two premiums, why shouldn't they be able to recover under the separate policy provisions?
Well, you have to buy insurance on an a la carte basis. When you go in, you make a decision on whether you want to buy the coverage or not to buy the coverage. But when you pay the premiums, either in bulk or separately, you only get what you bargained for.
Is it made clear to the purchasers of insurance that they may be buying something that they really don't need, or they may be paying for something that they may not be provided coverage for later because of circumstances like this? Or are the consumers left in the dark?
Well, you can give somebody a policy of insurance, but you can't make them read it. I don't know if it would be on a person-by-person basis.
Can you explain it to them?
Absolutely, and I'm sure that that's why policies are usually purchased on a face-to-face or now telephone-type basis and everything. But, again, this is not where each individual company goes out and crafts their own contract language. This is a standard policy of insurance. You get everything you bargain for into that contract of insurance. The PIP is there up front and fast on a no-fault basis to pay you if you've had an accident and you've lost wages or you've incurred medical bills. Later, if you decide that you've got additional damages and you want to go off and sue your insurance company or claim against the company for an underinsured or uninsured motorist, you also get the benefit of that. and that's over and above the amount that you paid in PIP.
Mr. Paxson, isn't it true that the contract requires an offset, or permits an offset?
Right, and that contract language starts off in order to avoid payment of benefits in excess of actual damages.
So the reasonable expectations of the insurers are that they understand that it's subject to offset.
Right. No one should go into a policy of insurance expecting double recovery.
The respondents argue that we've decided this issue in Dabney. Why doesn't Dabney control in this case?
Different contract, different language, different result. Dabney needs to be read in conjunction with Westchester Fire. In Westchester Fire, you had a policy of insurance, and the language back then required that any payment under PIP would actually reduce the policy limits. Completely different set of facts that produces completely different results when you start doing the math after a loss. That's not the policy before the court today at all.
Do we have to overrule Dabney or Westchester Fire in order to reach the result that you'd have us reach?
No, hypothetically, if somebody brought a policy of insurance that had that type of language in it, and had a Texas court interpret it under Texas law, that's still the rule. The problem here is that we got a different policy of insurance with different contract language, and we're not trying and have never attempted to offset the PIP payments against the policy limits, only against the actual damages, so no one gets double recovery.
Well, let me ask you about double recovery. Why would anybody purchase uninsured motorist coverage?
Because there's an awful lot of uninsured motorists on the street.
Is uninsured motorist coverage designed to replace that other person's insurance? I'm buying it to cover me because the other person may not have it.
The idea behind it is for your protection against financial loss as a result of uninsured motorist negligence.
Okay, so if the other person has insurance coverage, could they take an offset for the fact that I have PIP?
No, sir, they couldn't.
Okay, so I buy uninsured motorists to insure. I buy uninsured motors under the risk that the other party won't have insurance.
Yes, sir.
So why should I get less coverage under my uninsured motors that I'm trying to replace just because the other side doesn't have insurance?
First off, it's meant to replace it to the extent of compensatory damages. The idea is that you're going to get your actual damage. You're going to get the full benefit of your policy if the other person is uninsured. But it's always been construed as being compensatory. For example,
uninsured motorist coverage is not designed to replace a third party's insurance coverage up to a certain limit. It's just a different kind of insurance coverage.
Right. First off, the carrier is a defendant by virtue of contract, not by tort. Mid-Century Insurance Company is not the tortfeasor in this case. And so when you start looking at different rules of law like the collateral source rule, we're not the tortfeasor. We are a defendant by way of contract. UM coverage has always been a compensatory vehicle. For example, the courts of appeals have consistently held that you don't get to recover punitive damages against your your UM coverage. It's
but
a compensatory
aren't there cases claim. That specifically say the purpose of the UM statute is to put the claimant in the same position they would be in as if they had been hit by an insurer? And if those cases do in fact say that, how do we get around that language?
Well, those cases, or if you just want to take one pithy statement out of a case, you can find language by which you can build a syllogism by which you require double recovery. But when you go back and you look at the statute, it was put out there in order to protect people from financial harm resulting from uninsured motorists. It is a compensatory plan.
Well, let's look at the statute. In particular, let's look at 5.06-15. As I read it, it says, the underinsured motorist coverage shall provide for payment to the insured of all sums which he shall be legally entitled to recover as damages. It doesn't say all actual damages, but it says all sums which he is legally entitled to recover. Here we have a judgment for the $13,000. Because it is a judgment, that means that the insured is legally entitled to recover those sums. Why does 5.06-15 not tie your hands?
This is an uninsured motorist case as opposed to an underinsured motorist. The underinsured motorist provision would talk about, this is the offset for the other driver's liability coverage. In other words, you go out and you settle and get a verdict against the tortfeasor. This provision simply states that you go ahead and offset that amount against what you might could recover against your underinsured motorist coverage. But it's not meant to go ahead and have the interplay between the policy provisions, which is what we're talking about in terms of you paid PIP under the same policy. There's nothing collateral about the source of payment here. Under the same policy, we're supposed to pay it again under UM. That's what the respondent argues. That's what the 8th Court held. And you've got to go ahead and read this policy fairly. There's no way you can read this policy, and no one has ever argued this policy is ambiguous, not to date. When you read this policy, the only fair reading is that they're going to pay you the PIP fast and up front for your lost wages and medical. But when you go ahead and you make a claim under the same policy for UM, at that point in time, you're going to be capped at your actual damages. No one's going to come out ahead on this deal. And we have had cases out of this court before, for instance, the Bridge versus American Motorist case, where there's two completely different UM policies applying to the same loss, the employee's personal policy and the employer's policy. And they've been harmonized, the two policies together, not to allow recovery of more than actual damages. We're not trying to short anybody. We're wanting to pay this man his actual damages as liquidated and found by the jury. But $13,000 in medical bills shouldn't require a payment of $23,000 under the policy of insurance. So the rule against double recovery is the rule that obtains here. There's three arguments that the respondent set forth against enforcement of the policy as written. Number one, that Dabney doesn't allow it. And again, Dabney is a different contract which meets with a different result. Number two, that the insurance code doesn't provide for it. Mr. Krennic is going to visit with you in just a little bit about the history of the statute and legislative intent behind it. But one thing I do want to point out, one of the things that they like to key off of is the idea that there is a statutory provision in the liability section of the insurance code that's completely inapplicable here that limits a PIP credit to guests and passengers. I'll give you an example. You're riding in a car and the driver of your car is negligent. Well, because you're occupying a covered auto, you're entitled as a covered person to PIP benefits. Later, when you make a claim against the driver of that auto, that same carrier, now defending on the liability portion, would have a PIP credit. That provision demonstrates the strong public policy in favor of avoiding double recovery.
But couldn't the legislature have added on this particular category of claimant as opposed to limiting it to just passengers and guests?
It would have been unnecessary. The statutory provision was actually required because in that situation where you're going to go ahead and sue the driver of that car, the collateral source rule is applicable there. You're not a subscriber. You're not the insured under that policy of insurance. You're a third-party claimant against their insured in that context. To abrogate the collateral source rule, you needed a statutory provision, and that's where you see 5.5063H come in. In our situation, it's by virtue of contract.
Mr. Paxson, I want to go back to the statute cited by Justice Abbott. I'm troubled by the term all sums. It seems to me that a party cannot contract in violation of the statute. Do you agree with that?
Could you repeat that again?
That a party cannot contract in violation of the statute. So even though the parties may contract to have an offset, that is not a valid provision if it's in violation of the statute, which requires recovery of all sums. What is the public policy argument for not allowing someone to recover all sums pursuant to this statute?
Couple. First off, that statute is specifically dealing with underinsured motorist coverage, which is a completely different fact pattern than an uninsured motorist. The intent of this provision is to go ahead and make sure that you get an offset for the liability coverage of the tortfeasor. Whatever you're able to recover from the tortfeasor is offset against your underinsured motorist coverage. This provision when you look at it in the context of what they're trying to do, is actually an offset provision meant to avoid double recovery. That's the intent of this section. Secondly, in terms of public policy, there are separate premiums. One of the things that we know from the Ramos decision from the Texas Department of Insurance Commissioner is that right now we're paying less for UM and UIM because the PIP credit and offset is part of the rate-making process. The respondents are trying to get something that they didn't pay for. They're trying to change the contract. The contract was meant and rated on a specific actuarial basis. So the public policy behind it is trying to get something that you didn't pay for or contract for.
Could you explain to me why then is there a separate premium charge for that particular coverage? And I've forgotten, is it required or is it voluntary coverage?
PIP adheres to all contracts mm-hmm. unless you reject it in writing. Mm-hmm. UM adheres to all contracts unless you reject mm-hmm. it in writing. And a lot of people make a financial decision to reject it in writing. Mm-hmm. When you buy insurance today, it's on an a la carte basis. You can decide whether or not you want collision coverage. The thing you got to have is a liability coverage. You got to have 2040 liability coverage in order to ride legally on the highways. Everything else is your option and your consumer decision.
So the basic structure of the policy is it's all there and you back off by declining.
Yes, sir.
And so that's why they break out the premium, so you're not paying separate if you get the whole thing. Is that...
You can't lump sum price it because there's a lot of decisions. You go through and pick and choose on an a la carte basis what you want in your insurance policy.
So does that answer Judge Abbott's question of, well, aren't we paying for two separate things and shouldn't we get coverage rather than credits or offsets?
This court has previously rejected the notion that payment of separate premiums results in automatic intra-policy stacking.
Mm-hmm.
That has not been the rule in Texas. And at this point in time, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Mel Krennic.
Court, please. I'm Mel Krennic from San Antonio. I represent Nationwide Insurance Company in that portion of this case. At the outset, I have to address one point in the San Antonio court's opinion. In the Gerlich case, and Appley devotes, I think, four sentences of their brief to this, but it regards the disagreement among the members of the appellate court as to whether the parties had stipulated on the amount of damages in the case. The record will show that there was no disagreement between the parties. We filed a written stipulation. We all agreed. Showing the total damages of Ms. Gerlich to have been $3,500. The judgment in the trial court says specifically actual damages, $3,500. Nationwide had paid $2,200 in PIP benefits. There was no fact dispute in the trial court or in the Court of Appeals, and the fact question was not briefed. There was not a single question asked us in argument before the three-judge panel that heard the case. When the opinion came down from the en banc panel, for the first time the court raised the fact issue or the possibility of a fact issue that maybe this $3,500 was not the total damages of Ms. Gerlich.
One thing I don't understand, apparently you all agreed, you had a settlement agreement
in
which you agreed to pay $3,500.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why aren't you bound by that settlement agreement? You agreed to pay $3,500.
Yes.
Why aren't you bound to pay $3,500 without any
offset? Only subject to the PIP offset in the contract. We rely on the contract. It says we had previously paid $2,200 of PIP benefit.
Does your settlement agreement say subject to PIP, or does it reference PIP?
It just says total settlement, $3,500, and we say here's your $3,500 less the PIP offset, which we're entitled to under the contract.
But you settled after you'd already made the PIP payments.
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't understand why you're not bound to pay an additional $3,500 under your settlement agreement.
Well, it was all part of the agreed facts that we went up on to the trial court. The company said, we will settle. We will pay you your total damage, $3,500, but we get the PIP offset, so you only get $1,200 and some odd. And the plaintiff said, we disagree with you. We think you owe us $3,500, but let's take it into court and have an agreed set of facts and take it on up to see if you're entitled to the offset. It was, the court has to realize this is a very small amount of money.
You agreed to disagree as part of your
Yes, Your Honor, that, very clearly that. And the Kessler case cited in our brief, as far as the Court of Appeals opinion, says that in a case involving agreed facts, the only issue on appeal is whether the trial court properly applied the law to the agreed facts. And this case, the Gerlich case, is not fact-specific, and I think it was properly consolidated with the Kidd case for the court's consideration of the legal issues. The question of law before the court, and I hope I don't repeat anything that counsel has said, but the question of law is, should the PIP offset against total actual damages recoverable under the UM provisions of the standard Texas auto policy be held to be void and unenforceable so as to allow insureds to obtain a double recovery of their damages?
How do you deal with the PIP statute itself? Article 5.06-3, Section C, specifically says that you're required to pay these benefits without regard to any collateral source.
Yes, Your Honor.
How do you deal with that language?
The PIP benefits are paid without regard to any collateral source, and they were in this case. Ms. Gerlich and Mr. Kidd both received full PIP benefits. No question. I was going to address that under legislative intent. But they received their full PIP benefits. When they made their UM claims, they received their full actual damages under the UM claim.
What if they'd made a claim under the UM policy first? Would they be entitled to come back and get their PIP benefits in addition to the UM coverage?
I can't think of a way that could happen, Your Honor. I guess it could. They're always entitled to their PIP benefits. That's the immediate, quick money, get them through the rough time money that, as it's been described in some of the cases. If they make a UM claim first, it seems to me the company would say, are you going to make a PIP claim? If so, that'll be...
We're not telling you. We're claiming under our UM provision. We'll worry about PIP later.
Yeah.
Are they entitled to do that?
I think the company would be able to say at that point, well, if you make a PIP claim later, it's going to be... you've already been paid for those damages, so it'll be deducted.
But then what do you do about the collateral source language under the PIP statute?
Well, the rule, to my knowledge, is that the collateral source rule does not apply if the source from which the primary benefit or from which the benefits are sought is not collateral to the primary source of benefits. It's all the same policy, in other words. The source is not collateral when you're obtaining PIP benefits and UM benefits.
Let me ask you quickly about, you were getting ready to get into legislative intent.
Yes, Your Honor.
And there are cases that say the legislature's intent behind this statute is to put the claimant in the same position they would be in as if they had been hit by an insured. Do you share counsel's assessment that that language is pithy?
I do, Your Honor. And the Brown opinion, one of the recent opinions upholding the PIP offset, addresses that. It says, and I don't think it's a valid argument to say, well, if they had been insured, then we would get a double recovery. As the Brown opinion says, we're talking apples and oranges here. We're talking a third-party claim if they were insured. We're talking first-party claim, contractual claim under the UM coverage. And the Brown case says over and over, it's different facts. It's not the same. You cannot compare these.
So you think those cases were just wrong in stating that that was the legislature's intent?
No, Your Honor. I think it's a good way to look at UM coverage from one standpoint and say, hey, it's just like this was liability coverage, but it's not the same when you get down to the nitty-gritty of what kind of a claim is it. When we first got these cases to defend back in the 70s, we didn't know what kind of cases they were, at least in San Antonio. We went under the adage, if it looks like a duck and acts like a duck. Well, these looked like liability claims, the UM claims. You tried them like a liability claim. I went in and defended numerous uninsured motorists as my clients, and the insurance company was kept as a silent defendant. We did that on motion. This court and the subsequent lower courts told us, you're wrong. These are first-party claims. They're governed by the rules of contract. They have a 4-year statute of limitations. You may recover, they may recover attorney's fees under this. This is a different breed of cat. So it may look like liability, but it's not. And don't compare it. Don't handle them that way.
Let me ask you a question, Mr. Crank. The, are you familiar with the case, you know, Schaefer versus Unigard?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. In that case, it seemed the argument was made that the PIP endorsement was really a separate agreement of insurance that was not affected by other provisions in the policy to which it was attached. Primarily that had to do with the driver exclusion that was under the policy, and the court concluded that the exclusions under the policy didn't apply to the insurance provided by the PIP coverage. Now, I understand your argument saying that, that we have to remember this is a defendant by contract, not a defendant by tort.
That's
and
right.
So the contract governs what responsibilities between the parties are based on a condition, which is that this driver who caused the accident was uninsured. But it seems to me you're arguing that there's a provision of the policy, that affects the coverage by PIP.
It's my understanding that the Unigard case said that the insurance company cannot limit the extent of PIP coverage by this exclusion, by saying this is an excluded driver, therefore the passengers don't have any PIP. It's excluded under the policy. And this court said, you can't do that. That's limiting the extent of PIP coverage. The PIP offset doesn't limit or even affect the extent of PIP coverage. And as I said earlier, both Ms. Gerlich and Mr. Kidd receive full PIP benefits. And it's our contention they've received full UM benefits. The only thing they are complain about is that they didn't get some of them twice.
Why do you think the legislature, when it passed the uninsured motorist coverage statute, went to such great pains in Section 4B to talk about double recovery when you're talking about property damage?
Yes, Your Honor.
Talked about you get when you've got two provisions of policy,
that's,
and how that works, and finally says in no event shall you be entitled to recover twice. Why don't you? Why do you think they just did that with respect to property damage and didn't do that for personal injury?
May I respond? The property damage offset, and that's what it is. It's an offset under collision damage, UM. You can't recover, make a double recovery. That was passed in 1979. That was an amendment in 1979. The PIP offset had been in the policy for several years at that time. And I think this is an excellent argument that legislative intent is shown against double recovery. The legislature said, we don't want them to have a double recovery under property damage, and we're going to amend the statute. They already don't have a double recovery because of the PIP offset. And it, to me, it shows legislative intent that the legislature is saying there cannot be double recovery under any portions of the standard Texas automobile policy.
Where is the PIP offset under these circumstances in the statute?
It's not in the statute. It's in the contract. And as Commissioner Bomer said in his opinion, that the 97 opinion that's attached to all the briefs, he said it's been in there for 20 years. The insurance companies have been relying on it. They rate their policies. It's been there all this time. And that's what I say as to the property damage offset. It was there. The companies had been relying on it, rating their policies, selling them, and using the PIP offset. And then the 79 amendment on property damage just shows the legislature's further intent. There's no case in Texas history that I know of, no evidence in the legislative intent or in insurance principles that allow this double recovery and say you should make a profit from your insurance policy.
Obviously. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court. Ms. Mara Blatt and Mr. Larry Sims will present argument for the respondents. Ms. Blatt will open with the first 15 minutes.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Mara Blatt, and I have the pleasure to represent the respondent, Mr. Jack Kidd, in the Kidd versus Mid-Century matter. There are 2 points that I'd like to make to the court today. The first is that the UM and PIP statutes do not actually prohibit the offset of PIP benefits against Kidd's UM claim. And as such, Mid-Century's proposed interpretation of its policy must be found void as a matter of law. The second is that MidCentury's attempt to raise the specter of double recovery or recovery in excess of actual damages is misplaced in that this court's precedents, the statutory scheme, and public policy support rather than forbid the complete recovery that was awarded Kidd at trial and that was affirmed by the Eighth Court of Appeals.
But do you disagree with Mr. Paxson's explanation of what the rate structure is for the PIP and UM coverage? That in fact the offset is taken into account with the rate structure that applies to the standard Texas automobile policy?
Well, certainly with regard to the calculation of premiums, the commissioner's opinion indicates that, yes, that is taken into account.
So, in fact, the insured then is not paying for coverage it didn't get if the offset is allowed.
Well, I think one of the justices alluded to the fact that if there is still two separate premiums that are paid for this coverage, and the way the premiums may be calculated is not necessarily revealed to the consumer.
I understand, but do you disagree that in fact what is happening is as the rate structure is set, the offset is taken into account, so in fact the premium is less on UM coverage than it otherwise would be if the offset were not allowed? Do you disagree with his representation that that's in fact the way the rate structure works?
That was not an issue. We did not receive any evidence on that. It wasn't an issue that came up in our case.
You don't know one way or the other?
I don't know.
And you don't know, in contrast to that, that in fact insureds are paying for full UM coverage without offset and then not getting that if an offset is allowed. You don't know the contrary either?
Well, I can answer it only from personal experience that if you look at the policy that you receive every 6 months, there isn't any indication that there is an offset.
No, I'm just talking
but
about
I understand what you're saying.
You really can't say one way or the other whether
no.
you agree or disagree with Mr. Paxson.
No, because I don't have any evidence on that.
What about his argument about the construction of the uninsured motorist statute, that the legislature already thought there were PIP credits, and when they tried to align the property damage side of it, they weren't trying to say that there were double recovery possibilities.
Do you mean the property damage
yes.
in the UM portion of the statute?
What about his argument that they were trying to align it with existing law regarding personal injury?
Well, I think it's precisely the opposite, actually, because the property damage portion of the UM statute was added in 1977, and what that showed was that... I'm sorry, let me just... If the legislature had wanted to deal with the issue of offsets in the bodily injury portion of the statute, it certainly could have done so at the same time that it added the property damage language into the UM statute.
But is it possible the legislature decided to leave that arena to the parties to contract, to deal with by contract?
Well, if the legislature... well, certainly, yes, the parties can be left to contract with one another as they see fit, but what the contract, if it violates the statute, still is not valid. And as such, clearly the legislature had the idea of offsets in its mind when it put this extra provision in for property damage. And the fact that it didn't add that to the bodily injury, I think, is indicative of precisely the opposite. That
is there any sound public policy reason for prohibiting offsets for property damage but not for bodily injury? Prohibiting double recovery for offsets but not for bodily injury? Prohibiting double recovery for property damage but not prohibiting it for bodily injury.
The underlying policy on UM is that the person who is injured is supposed to be put in the same position that they would have been in had they hit an insured, had they had the dubious fortune to be hit by an insured motorist. I think if you look at this court's cases, you see that even in those cases where stacking is not allowed, the actual intent is that the insured motorist gets one full UM recovery. If that has to be accomplished in some cases by stacking, then it is, and if not, then the motorist is still covered for all bodily injury. and that is the public policy behind the UM statute.
Just because the state has a public policy that says a tortfeasor shouldn't get the benefit of the person they injured having the foresight to buy insurance, that is, not the benefit of collateral source. The tortfeasor should pay the full amount of the damages. We don't look to see what other money is available. Does that translate into a public policy that considers a double recovery to be proper? You understand my question? We're talking about, you're saying the public policy is for Mr. Kidd to get a full recovery. And in the tortfeasor context, the public policy would mean a double recovery. And I'm saying, is that necessarily equal? It seems to me once the policy says the defendant shouldn't benefit, the defendant, the tortfeasor shouldn't benefit from the fact that Mr. Kidd got insurance, but that doesn't translate into the fact that Mr. Kidd ought to get a double recovery, because if this had been a third party, he would have.
When in the third party situation, we don't even call that double recovery. We don't say that because Mr. Kidd would be entitled to his PIP in a third party situation and could still recover his full $13,000 from the uninsured motorist, that we don't call that double recovery. We say that's how the statute works. Well, the same thing applies here, especially when you consider that the PIP statute has an absolute prohibition on subrogation and also says that the benefits should be available without regard to the collateral, any collateral source.
But isn't the purpose of that to facilitate quick payment of these kinds of claims so the insured doesn't have to wait?
That is one purpose of PIP insurance, but on the other hand, if mid-century's interpretation is adopted here, in essence what we're doing is we're just taking with one hand, giving them quick benefits with one hand, and then taking them away. There is no it's an illusion that there's a benefit there.
Isn't it critical, though, to the analysis in this case that that both of these claims are first-party insurance claims?
Not if you consider that there are separate premiums paid for the coverage.
But doesn't that then depend on looking at the rate structure as to whether or not the premium is appropriately take into account the offset provision of the contract?
It does have implications for the rate structure. However, the difference that in net effect we're probably talking about is a few dollars in either direction.
But a few dollars multiplied times all the automobile insurance policies issued in the state of Texas and all the premiums paid is a lot of dollars.
That's certainly true, but as an insured, I'd rather pay a few extra dollars and be assured that I get all of the coverage which I believed I was contracting for. And certainly in this case, there was evidence that Kidd was not advised of this offset provision at all.
When you buy insurance, do you expect to buy insurance that will pay you more than what your loss is? Is that one of your expectations as a consumer?
As a consumer, my expectation is that I get the benefit of the coverage that I pay for. And
that
again,
goes back to the
and
rate structure,
well,
doesn't it?
Well, but again, the point here is that what we're calling double recovery in this other circumstance, the circumstance which UM is precisely designed to address, that is that you are put back in the position that you would have been in, that you are entitled to legally recover all sums that you that you have available to you. If that's the case, that's not double recovery, and that is my expectation under the policy. So even though I see that there is no difference between the fact that Kidd is making a claim, even though it's pursuant to his own policy, it's still pursuant to a separate coverage for which he paid premiums, and
Do you agree, though, that your argument breaks down if, in fact, the rate structure takes into account the offset? Yes or no?
No, because I think there are other public policy provisions that feed into the purpose of the two statutes, and the interaction of the two statutes is such that the offset should be prohibited.
One question, you alluded to Mr. Kidd not being advised about the credit. Is it a correct statement that this is purely and simply a contract issue and not one for fraud, or that he was, quote, misled to his detriment, and therefore that's a ground for recovery, but we're just looking at a contract cause of action, pure and simple?
No. This case needs to be resolved at the statutory level, and it is our contention that the statutes indicate that the policy provision should be voided.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I see that I'm out of... Oh, I'm sorry.
Actually,
I still
you're
do,
not.
I still actually do have time. I'd like to also talk, though, about the Dabney decision. The Dabney decision is on point with this case. The Dabney court specifically noted that the PIP coverage at issue in that case arose from the standard automobile insurance policy. The commissioner's opinion, which has been offered by the other side in this case, indicates that that policy provision has been in effect since 1977. If Dabney was decided in 1982, and therefore the Dabney court did have the same provision in front of it.
Let me ask you, what weight or deference do we give to an order or an opinion of the commissioner here?
In this case, this court requires, the commissioner's opinion is not required to have any deference per se by this court. The only area in which deference has to be given by the court is if it's actually part of the rulemaking authority of the commissioner. It's also clear that the Dabney case had precisely the same issue in front of it that's in front of the court today, which is whether or not a PIP credit can be given as an offset against UM benefits claimed. And for those reasons, the Dabney court, the Dabney opinion is essentially on point with this case. I'd like to return, however, to the UM statute and the fact that the legislature's choice of language with regard to 5.064B, which is the property damage provision of the UM statute, comports with this court's holdings that the insured is still entitled to the full one full UM coverage recovery pursuant to one limit in each one of those cases. I would also point out that in this court's 1978 Unigard decision and in the 1982 Dabney decision, this court held that the exclusions that are contained in Section E of the PIP statute were the only exclusions that were permitted under the PIP statute. And indeed, 4 years later in Dabney, this court also held that there was no offset of PIP benefits against UM coverage. The point here is that if the legislature had intended that there would be a PIP coverage, an offset allowed, certainly Dabney and Unigard would have been red flags to the legislature to then go back and reformulate the statute so that such an offset provision could be included in the PIP statute. That was not done, and those cases still stand. And that is, I think, further support for the conclusion that the legislative scheme under PIP does not allow an offset to be taken.
Did the insured in Dabney recover more than the amount of the full damages? Or was the net effect and the result of the case that, in fact, it was compensation for the extent of the damages and not beyond?
We don't know that from the language of the Dabney case, but what we do know about Dabney is that it was a case like this one. It was not an excess damages case. This was a case where the damages of the plaintiffs were within the limits of the policy itself.
But you don't know one way or the other whether or not the insured in that case recovered more than the actual loss?
No. I see my time is up. Thank you for your attention.
Any other questions? Thank you.
May it please the court, in answer to your question, Justice Hankinson, they did make a double recovery in Dabney. We have the judgment in Dabney. We have the actual jury awards in Dabney. There was a double recovery in Dabney. It is exactly the same situation as this, exact same contract provision.
So we'd have to overrule Dabney in order to go with the insurance companies in this case.
You have to overrule Dabney. You have to also overrule, I believe, Unigard v. Schaefer.
So they recovered in excess of their damages.
They did. Wasn't there credits taken for
comparative negligence in that case?
Yes, there were credits taken for comparative. There were credits taken because all of the plaintiffs in that case were found negligent to some degree, so credit was taken off for that matter. However, the judgment was in the amount for the uninsured motorist coverage, and they had already received PIP. And that judgment of the uninsured motorist coverage was under the uninsured limits. They were all the judgments, even the woman who was killed, was under $10,000 in that case. And in fact, we have the actual judgments in that case.
So have you read the Dallas Court of Appeals decision on this same issue that goes against you?
The Kim case.
Yes.
Yes.
Do you disagree then with the Dallas Court's analysis of Dabney?
Yes.
The Dallas Court concludes that they were only compensated up to the full extent of their damages as a result of the comparative fault.
They didn't read the file. I mean, this is the judgment in Dabney. It came from y'all's records. You can check it. Okay? The judgment for one, the woman who was killed, was $6,611.40. That's for the uninsured motorist coverage. The judgment for the second plaintiff was in $3,286.69. For the third plaintiff, it was $251.87. That was his uninsured coverage. He had been paid over $500 in PIP. If they took a PIP, credit in that case, he would have got zip. He would have actually owed them money back. You can check it. It's in your file.
Thank you.
In answer to your question, Justice Owen, about the addition of the uninsured motorist coverage in 1977-1979, I've reviewed the legislative history for both of those acts and those amendments. I've read every tape there is on that. I've looked at the bill file on that. Never did any when they added that bodily injury language in Section 3 of the UM statute, they added the same language about property damage in Section 4. At the same time, that language on bodily injury in 3A did not exist before 1977, nor did that property damage language. Clearly, they thought the property damage was going back to the PIP statute they passed in 73, and I've reviewed that legislative history. And it's clear that they wanted folks to get their PIP regardless of the existence of other benefits. That's the whole point of that Section 3C. It never occurred to them that if they didn't give the insurance companies the right to subrogate against somebody, the third-party driver who hadn't paid premiums and who was at fault, that somehow they'd be able to subrogate against their own insured who had paid premiums and wasn't at fault. It never occurred to them that somebody would actually allow that to happen.
Since you checked all the background on everything, have you checked the rate structure, and can you respond to Mr. Paxson's argument?
Yeah, I can, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I can tell you that from our experience, that there's a reason why you only had one case in between. You had Dabney in 82, you had James, which was basically, Lucas out of Texarkana, which was a year or two later, was already in the mill. And then in between 1982 and Dabney and 1998 in the Kim case, you only had one case, and that was James. Now all of a sudden you've got about six, seven, eight cases all of a sudden. Why? Because this is the first time they've been insisting on their PIP credit. They followed Dabney for years. This Gerlich had her accident in 1995, and frankly, we brought this case because that's the first time we had an insurance company insist on that PIP credit.
Well, but Mr. Paxson says that the rate structure takes into account the offset. So in fact, the insureds are paying under a rate structure that includes consideration for the offset, therefore the premiums are less. Is that right or not?
I don't think it is, but let's assume it is.
Do you know one way or the other?
No, and he doesn't either, because there's no evidence in this record. You can check the record of both cases, and you won't find any evidence on rate structure. You're going to have to go outside this record, make some phone calls, and find out, because it's not in this record.
Well, we have a decision of the commissioner that's in the record.
You do?
That says that, as a general matter, this is taken into account.
You do? And clearly that was something he would know.
Who would know better than the commissioner?
Who would know? But he wasn't commissioner early on. And I would suggest, All I can tell you is our experience, and just look at the case law and how it's developed, and why this issue has only all of a sudden everywhere cropped up. And the reason is because they weren't paying the PIP credit. I mean, they weren't insisting on it, and the reason was because y'all's decision in Dabney. They were following it.
How long has the language been in the policy about?
According to the commissioner, it's been in since 1977. The accident in Dabney occurred September 1st, 1978. Y'all decided that case in 1982. This exact same provision, it's the exact same situation. Folks are making a double recovery off their UM and their PIP. It is factually indistinguishable.
Is there some sort of general waiver of contract provisions if people just don't enforce a contract provision from time to time over the years?
Yes. Have you ever known an insurance company just not do it? I mean, they're going to insist on it, on everything. They're going to play it by the book.
Well, again, we have no evidence in this record either that they're not offsetting with the PIB. I would
that's true.
That they're going to stand up here and tell us that
that's
years
true.
They have been offsetting.
And that is true. It is not in the record either way. There's no evidence as to rate structure. You can look at the record and see there's only one case basically in between Dabney and Kim in a period of 18 years, and that was James. And now you've got how many cases just sort of in the middle around the state?
So your argument really is that this offset is in the contract, but it's either against public policy, so it ought to be out of the contract, or I guess that's it.
Well, it's public policy. It's written in the statute. When the legislature passed both the UM and PIP statutes, they made a pact with the people of Texas. They said, you got to buy this coverage. This is mandatory. Unless you go to the trouble of rejecting this coverage in writing, it's going to be in your policy, and you got to pay for it. And in return, they made a deal. Okay, we're going to force you to buy this coverage, but doggone it, we're going to make sure you get it. This is statutory coverage. This isn't contractual coverage. These coverages are determined by a statute. And for years, this court rigorously defended that public policy. And the legislature made this deal with the people. They said, you can't get this coverage.
I mean, I understand that you get this $2,500, whatever the limit is, and you can't lose that. That's yours. Now, you can go out here and buy some other policy. You can buy hospitalization. You could buy uninsured motorist. You can buy that policy over there. Now, that policy could have a provision of offsets and credits. Now, I mean, is there a public policy that says the insurance company can't, with respect to its own insurer, not contract for offsets and credits or one-half their damages or three-quarters of their damages?
They can't on the PIP credit because think about it. Folks aren't getting PIP benefits. There's a reason why we call it a PIP credit, because they're getting a credit in the exact amount of the PIP that's been paid. It's like an advance in a lawsuit. A lawyer makes an advance to a client early on for a quick payment to help them through troubled times, and then when the case settles, lawyer takes the advance out of his final settlement. That's exactly what's going on here. These aren't PIP benefits that are being paid. These are PIP advances that are being paid.
Do you think in the future, if things don't work out for you here, and the case goes the other way, that parties will first file a UM claim and then go back and seek the double recovery by then filing the PIP claim?
They might, and I'm sure the insurance companies will take it out somewhere at the end of the game.
But I guess what I'm asking is that legally workable for a party, and is it going to be likely that that will occur?
I don't know if it's likely, but in the end, it just becomes a semantic shell game. I mean, where are your benefits? Here, their benefits are here, and then bang, they're gone later on. I mean, that's what's going to happen. People are going to pay a PIP premium. Mrs. Gerlich paid a PIP premium in this case. If she had never paid a PIP premium, she's going to recover the same amount in UM benefits, total recovery, than she would have if she paid the premium. And think about this, that...
But her premiums on the UM are lower.
I don't know if they are or not, and that record hasn't been developed. We have the commissioner's opinion, and that's really all we've got on that.
But her UM premiums also go to property damage. It just so happens she didn't have property damage in this case.
Actually, I think she did, but it wasn't they paid that.
But my point is you're paying a premium not just for personal injury coverage under UM coverage. It's also
right.
The property damage coverage.
Well, but there are separate premiums for that. If you look at the transcript on page 21, there's a deck sheet, and it's not very readable. But you'll see the list of the premiums for all the different coverages. And it's you get a different premium for the property damage UM than you do from the bodily.
Can you elect to get UM just for personal injury as opposed to the whole thing? I thought when you got UM, you got the whole ball of wax. You don't divide it between personal injury and property damage.
You can reject just property. You can just get property damage or just reject that. Those are separate. UM bodily injury and UM property damage are separate. You can reject either.
A question earlier asked, was there any reason, public policy reason, why a double recovery of property damages should be prohibited by the legislature, but not double recovery of personal injury damage?
And the answer is yes. Because when they added that provision in 77, they had the PIP statute out there, which dealt with bodily injury recoveries. And they didn't want you to lose your PIP benefits, because if they had put that in there, you would have lost, they would have been entitled to this credit. But they didn't want you because they wanted that PIP to be paid. That's mandatory no-fault benefits paid without regard to the existence of other benefits. That's
why
they
shouldn't you get the same property benefits?
Pardon?
Why shouldn't you get the same property damage benefits?
Well, there's not the same policy. There's no statute that says collision coverage is a matter of law. There's no statute that says every policy has to have collision coverage. That's a voluntary coverage that you can get or not get. And there's no public policy of Texas that every automobile liability policy in Texas have property damage. There is a public policy of Texas that every automobile liability policy in Texas have PIP and UM. And you'd be able to recover for both.
Your case is the one that has the settlement agreement.
Yes.
Do you concede that, notwithstanding that settlement agreement, that the other side has the right to go ahead and appeal and contest this particular issue?
Yes. The stipulations speak for themselves. That's what we stipulated to. That was our agreement. We disputed the offset, and that was the whole point of bringing the lawsuit. And we both agreed to bring that. I do not want to foreclose their, at least, ability to appeal that on that ground, because we didn't have I don't think we had a written settlement agreement. It was an oral agreement. We've got this agreement. And we didn't agree to actual damages. We agreed to settle the thing for $3,500. And if we didn't do enough correct stipulations, we just didn't do it. They speak for themselves. But that's what we did. But I do not want to foreclose their ability to raise the issue, because I don't think that'd be fair, and that wasn't in the spirit of our agreement. In the short time I've had, I want to speak to some of the court's prior cases. You know, every time you all have dealt with the UM issue in Ranzau and Briggs, and then in Westchester Fire, and then in Dabney, and then also in Stroessner, you've always left, at the end of that case, you've always left the plaintiff, the consumer, in the same position they would have been if the third-party driver had liability insurance.
You don't think that language is pithy?
I don't think it's pithy at all. I think it's comforting. So, in order to speak to the legislators' intent and their public policy behind these statutes, you know, they wanted folks to get one UM recovery and one PIP recovery, not two UM recoveries or 17 PIP recoveries, but you pay your UM and you pay your PIP and you get one UM recovery and you get one PIP recovery, whatever the rates are. The legislature didn't set the rates. But they did know that they wanted folks to have the coverage. And if you allow PIP credit in this case, then in those cases where something that Mrs. Gerlich had absolutely no control over, she was hit by an uninsured driver instead of an insured one, she's going to suffer a financial loss if you allow this PIP credit. They didn't say actual damages. They said financial loss. And she will suffer that financial.
Is there anything in the statute, the bill analysis, the legislative history that states that is the purpose of enacting the UM statute, to put the claimant in as good a position? Anything actually written in the legislative history?
The original UM statute was passed in 67, and they didn't do tapes then. But clearly, if you just look at the statutory language, clearly they wanted it to replace that third-party liability insurance. That's what it's called, uninsured motorist coverage. It's for the uninsured driver as opposed to the insured one. And, you know, when you try a UM case, when you submit the elements to a jury, you submit negligence, you submit proximate cause, and you submit damages of the third-party driver. You submit that case the exact same way you would in a third-party negligence case. The elements are exactly the same. So UM is not some different kind of coverage. At least when we try those things, they're the exact same thing. We have to prove the exact same thing, and the policy says we have to prove the exact same thing. It is a substitute for that third-party liability insurance, and that's what they intended. And if you allow the PIP credit, it won't happen.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Paxson, seems to me an answer to one of the questions posed was perhaps the insured should submit the uninsured motorist claim first and put the insurance company in the position of having to pay that and then making the PIP claim later. What keeps the insured from doing it that way?
We were talking about different elements of damage, basically. The PIP only covers a small subset of the damages available in case.
But it seems to me that's a strong point they make. I'm injured. I submit an uninsured motorist claim to the insurance company. What are you evaluating then? You're evaluating what the damages are. Maybe you're in one of the counties that can give you a trial in 6 months. And you have a trial and you come down with the damages of $10,000. The insurance company's got to pay $10,000. Right?
Yes, sir.
Can the insurance company say, well, I'm going to withhold the amount of a PIP coverage? You couldn't, could you?
Well,
there's no offset yet. You haven't paid it, have you?
The El Paso Court of Appeals, in construing two PIP policies.
I'm just talking about uninsured. All I've done is claimed uninsured motorists. We've gone through the trial. There's a liability of $10,000.
Even though the statute talks about not without regard to collateral source, again, when it's the same carrier for the same elements of damage, there's nothing collateral about the source.
Well, you haven't paid me the PIP, so you can't take the offset, can you?
Well, no.
Okay.
I wouldn't take the offset then.
Now, I've said pay me my uninsured motorist. You pay the uninsured motorist. Now I make a claim for the PIP. Can you refuse to pay the PIP?
In that scenario, there's nothing collateral about the source. You wouldn't have any unpaid medical bills to be paid under PIP. There'd be nothing to be submitted to the company that hasn't already been compensated under the UM provision of the policy.
So you're saying if you've been paid for your damages by the third-party policy, that third-party out there has paid it, then you don't have to pay PIP.
Well, not the third-party, but the carrier, the UM carrier, has already paid it. And if you come back and now I want you to make you the PIP carrier too, I would argue that, no, you've already been paid, and it's not a collateral source that would implicate the statutory provision. And again, by way of analogy, the El Paso Court of Appeals in the USAA decision talked about when you had two PIP policies. And that can happen. You can't go ahead and take both PIP policies to pay the exact same bills. Again, the policy in this state in construing insurance policies is no one has a right to come out ahead. If you get two fire policies on your house and your house burns down, you don't get twice what the cost of your house was. As far as the rate making, again, who knows better than the commissioner?
Well, let's just talk about that for a second. Are you contending that the insurance industry can change a statute by restructuring its rates?
Absolutely not.
Difference does it make how they've structured their premiums? Aren't we supposed to look at the statute without regard to what the insurance industry thinks the statute says?
Just the notion was that somebody was paying for something they weren't getting. And the response is they're getting exactly what they paid for because they paid less for you.
What does that got to do with the statute?
Nothing.
Thank you.
When you look at the statute, I can agree that there is nothing specifically in black letters in the Vernons that says I get a PIP credit when somebody comes in and wants to collect UM benefits.
Then if it's not in the statute, how can it be in the policy?
Because the Texas Department of Insurance has great discretion in writing a UM policy. As long as it's not inconsistent with or repugnant to the statute, it can be in there. The statute also...
Can you respond to your opponent's argument that it is repugnant to the statute?
There's nothing in the UM statute that says you can't take a credit for PIP. There's just no such language. Again, they have great discretion in writing the policy, and there's a lot of things in the statute that says these are essential ingredients. You can't write a UM policy without these ingredients. but it's not meant to be an exhaustive list of ingredients.
Well,
the policy is not written by the legislature. It's written by the TDI.
If this were an underinsured situation, under Section 5, Section 5 says you pay all, and you only get a credit from the underinsured policy. Are you saying it's different depending on whether you're underinsured as opposed to uninsured?
No, ma'am. I'm saying you have to read the policy. You have to read the statute as a whole. That specific provision doesn't exist in a vacuum. That provision is an offset provision
because
that
you
says...
you pay all, and it says what offset you get doesn't give you an offset for PIP.
In an underinsured motorist context, they're saying you absolutely positively get the offset for the other guy's recovery.
And it says beyond that, you get all.
But again, taken as a whole, when you start looking at the entire statute, there's nothing in there that would be violated or repugnant to that statute when you say you're going to take a PIP credit.
Well, Mr. Zinn says, though, that the purpose in the statute of having the UM coverage and what the legislature was trying to do was to create the equivalent of the third-party liability insurance and therefore to allow the offset. You have to treat it the same way. And to allow the offset then is repugnant to the statute because it would be treating the UM coverage differently.
The actual bill that passed the legislature says that it's to protect Texans from financial loss. It's the intent and purpose of this act to provide a means of protecting the conscientious and thoughtful motorist against such loss, which refers to financial loss, which goes back to actual damages. We talk about pithy language. The Houston 14th Court said UM coverage is mandated by law with the stated purpose of relieving innocent motorists of actual losses. This case is about double recovery, not the collateral source rule.
Let me ask you real quickly. Mr. Zinn stated that since Dabney, there have been no offsets of PIP. Did I anticipate correctly that you would say that you have routinely been offsetting PIP, or have you not?
I can't speak for his unique and personal experiences, but I can tell you that this case has percolated forward because carriers are obviously taking the credit. This is not a case about waiver and estoppel. Throughout which has never been pled.
Well, I didn't mean to imply that. I got some impression that there was some routine in the industry based on Dabney, and are you disputing that is done?
In my personal experience, there was a great amount of confusion after Strachner and Hestelow as to what, if anything, a UM carrier could or should do. And back then, first-party bad faith was a raging animal. And so there was a lot of confusion back in the industry then as to whether or not any of the exclusion.
Are you saying you don't know whether those offsets have been taken or not?
I know that carriers have taken the offset. I don't know at what period in time and if what carriers have made what
decision. And you don't know whether it's routine or not.
Right. Usually $2,500 is not worth a fist fight. Can I speak to Dabney for just one moment? Dabney, I'm sorry.
Yes, go ahead.
The double recovery in Dabney, there are three plaintiffs. Goosby had no double recovery. Dabney had no double recovery. Haynes had double recovery of exactly $231.87. The briefs do not address double recovery. The court does not address double recovery. And I suspect that $231 is not enough in controversy to come forward to the Supreme Court and argue about.
How much are we dealing with here?
In the Kidd case, $10,000. We paid $10,000 in medical bills under the PIP. The same medical bills are then introduced in the UM case, and they find total accrued medical of $13,000. $2,200.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first case. The court